Good evening, and welcome to Blind Spot. Tonight on the program, we are proud to present Studio 35, featuring the talents of Anna Clark, Julia Klein, Brian Taylor, Eric S. Humphrey, John Wunzel, and myself. I'm Philip Von Zweck. Each week, Blind Spot presents a unique live radio experience that explores the possibility of the medium. For more information about the program, please visit our website at stopgostop.com/blindspot. One can say that by 1950, modern art in the United States had reached a point of sustained achievement worthy of a detached and democratic treatment. On April 21st to 23rd, 1950, a series of roundtable discussions occurred in New York about modern art. 56 years later, we retell the story. Live on WLUW 88.7 Chicago, Blind Spot presents Studio 35.
In the late fall of 1948, three abstract painters, William Baziotis, Robert Motherwell, Mark Rothko, and an abstract sculptor, David Hare, began a small cooperative school in Greenwich Village in New York City. Somewhat later, they were joined by another abstract painter, Barnett Newman. In the interest of introducing the students to as wide an experience as possible, other advanced artists, one by one, were invited to speak to the students on Friday evenings. The Friday evenings were open to the general public and quickly became a physical place for everyone interested in advanced art in the United States to meet. The audiences averaged about 150 persons, all that the loft on 8th Street that housed the school could hold.
For various reasons, the artists who founded the school, which was called the Subjects of the Artist, in order to emphasize that abstract art too had a subject, and that the curriculum consisted of the subjects that interest advanced artists, were unable to continue the school after the end of the year in May 1949. In the fall, several teachers in the New York University School of Art Education, Robert Eigelhart, Hale Woodruff, and Tony Smith, privately took over the loft and continued the Friday evenings, though not the school. It became known as Studio 35 after the address 35 East 8th Street. The Friday evenings were continued until April 1950.
Among the artists who lectured to a faithful and somewhat unvarying public during the two seasons, 1948 to 49 and 1949 to 50, were Arp, Baziotis, Jimmy Ernst, Ferber, Glarner, Gottlieb, Holtzman, Keyes, de Kooning, Motherwell, Newman, Reinhardt, and Rothko. Joseph Cornell gave several evenings from his fabulous collection of very early films. John Cage, the composer, Nicholas Callas, the poet and art critic, Richard Holzenbeck, one-time Dadaist and now psychoanalyst, Monsieur Levesque, a student of Dada, and Harold Rosenberg, the poet and critic, were among the others who addressed the Friday evenings. Many acquaintanceships and friendships grew up among the artists as a result of these meetings, which tended to become repetitious at the end, partly because of the public asking the same questions at the end of each meeting. To sum up the meetings, on the suggestion of Robert Goodnow, a graduate student in the NYU School of Art Education, who had been helping his instructors with the meetings of the second season, it was decided to have a closed 3-day session among the advanced artists themselves, with the dialogue taken down stenographically. There was no preliminary discussion of what was to be said. Nothing was arranged but the dates, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoons, 4 to 7 p.m., April 21st to 23rd, 1950.
Among the dozens of advanced artists asked to participate, the following attended one or more sessions: William Baziotis, Janice Biala, Louise Bourgeois, James Brooks, Willem de Kooning, Jimmy Ernst, Herbert Ferber, Adolf Gottlieb, Peter Grippe, David Hare, Hans Hoffmann, Veldon Keyes, Ibram Lassow, Norman Lewis, Richard Lippold, Seymour Lipton, Robert Motherwell, Barnett Newman, Richard Pouzet Dart, Ed Reinhardt, Ralph Rosenberg, Theodoros Stamos, Hedda Stern, David Smith, and Bradley Walker Tomlin.
The moderators were Alfred H. Barr Jr., the only non-artist participant, and one of the most noted modern art scholars, Richard Lippold, the sculptor, and Robert Motherwell, the painter, who had acted as moderator throughout the first session of Friday evenings. Lippold tended to carry the principal burden of moderating the first day, Barr the second, and Motherwell the third. Barr was prevented from being present the first day and from the first half of the final day.
The meetings were arranged by Robert Goodenough, who has drastically edited the following text, perhaps half of the original transcript of the proceedings. A few of the artists have made some corrections of what they said, but on the whole, this text retains the spontaneity, the unpreparedness, the rises and falls of intensity and pointedness of the meetings themselves, though a certain pathos and loneliness appears from time to time that was not as evident at the time of the meetings as it is on reading the original text.
The first day, April 21st, 1950. It might be advisable to list a few things which we will probably not want to discuss. It would seem the method of work of most of us has been a lonely one. I feel that much is gained from argument. I would like to learn from conversation with my conferrers.
We ought to define terms. Everybody here knows everybody else's work. There is little advantage in talking about schools of painting. I think we ought to discuss a particular problem. I don't see any point in discussing our own work. What a painter thinks he does is very often different from what he does. You can talk about your work, but the truth still remains concealed within the work, not within the words. We don't just want to hear everybody talking about his own point of view. I don't see that we can get anywhere unless we state a problem and then discuss that particular problem. Has somebody a suggestion?
The public has been mentioned, and it seems to me in a professional group like this we should attempt to identify our relationship to the public, perhaps in two ways. In a personal way, and in a way which relates to our work. By the second, I perhaps mean that the public really is asking all the time, what does this work mean? I think it might be helpful to adopt an attitude towards the public in the sense of an answer to that question. We needn't answer the question. What I'm asking is that we should adopt an attitude of either discarding the question or trying to answer it. Another thing I want to suggest we talk about is whether any of us feel that there is any difference in what is happening in America and what has happened heretofore, and in what is happening in Europe. There is some difference, which is not a question of geography, but a point of view. It is a question of origin or ancestry.
It seems to me that we are approaching an academy version of abstract painting. I think that has some bearing on our meeting here, in that I think, despite any individual differences, there's a basis for getting together on mutual respect and the feeling that painters here are not academic, and we should make some distinctions.
What is abstract art in the good sense?
The word abstract has a technical meaning. It means to take from. As a method, it signifies selecting one element from a myriad of elements for the purpose of emphasis. Whitehead says, the higher the degree of abstraction, the lower the degree of complexity. I suppose the word was first applied to a certain kind of art that was very highly abstracted, in Whitehead's sense, but consequently with a low degree of complexity. The people who first said abstract must have meant that so much was left out. Picasso represents a higher degree of complexity and a lower degree of abstraction than Mondrian, for example.
I feel that if we are going to learn something from each other, let's dismiss our problems in relation to the public and concern ourselves with the problems of creativity. How each one begins his piece of work and how he proceeds with it.
I was going to try to formulate a question out of this discussion. When Gottlieb raises the question of abstraction, I don't think we should just dismiss it. I mean, it might be formulated into this question. Do we artists really have a community? And if so, what makes it a community?
I see no need for a community. An artist is always lonely. The artist is a man who functions beyond or ahead his society. In any case, seldom within it. I think our problem would seem to be fundamentally psychological. Some feel badly because they are not accepted by the public. We shouldn't be accepted by the public. As soon as we are accepted, we are no longer artists, but decorators. Sometimes we think If we could only explain to the public, then they would agree with us. They may agree in the course of years, but they won't now. And they should not agree now. I think this group activity, this gathering together, is a symptom of fear. Possibly, you could connect this with the question of mass production, in the sense that it is the country where there is a feeling that unless you have a large public, you're a failure. The public is concerned with the average. I will always be opposed to this conception. I certainly don't think it is necessary to explain on the assumption that once you explain that there will be agreement.
There are many things that Hare brought up that I would like to discuss. I think we should follow some kind of procedure, isolate some ideas, and find out each artist's opinions. Newman's question was pertinent. Why can't we find out what our community is and how, and our differences and what our differences are, and what each artist might think of them?
What then exactly constitutes the basis of our community?
We need a common vocabulary. Abstract should really mean abstract, and modern should really mean modern. We don't mean the same things with the same words.
Why should we? Everyone should be as different as possible. There is nothing that is common to us, to all of us, except the creative urge. It just means one thing to me, to discover myself as well as I can. But everyone of us has the urge to be creative in relation to our time. The time to which we belong may work out in our own things in common. But to formulate this would not be simple. There are a great many differences which we should find out about here. If we are doing the same thing or have the same problems or have the same fears, what are they?
The museums can at any moment bless any one of us. The disaster is that they can also cause disparity among us too.
Does that have anything to do with the idea that was introduced by Hoffman before, of our art as a way of discovering ourselves?
I can't see that museums have anything to do with the artist. In general, museums are involved with art as decor, while the artist is involved with art as a way of life.
What we are leading up to is each person's point, each person paints or sculpts, why each person thinks he should paint. Do we do it to be a success, to make money, understand ourselves? Or what is the purpose? To describe our own creative nature? Why do we use titles? Where do we pick such titles? Where to begin?
It seems to me that most of the questions revolve around meaning. The public, the museums, and the artists themselves are involved in the question of meaning. It used not to be meaning in any simple sense, but when Mr. Lippold asks for a description of the way in which and the why for in connection with a piece of sculpture or painting, he is asking about meaning, I think.
That isn't what I said.
Then I misunderstood you. If we attempt to talk about what in general the work of this group has in common, I think that it has been mentioned that it is modern, advanced, and non-academic. We can rule out the problem of the museum because we will be telling the public in our own way what we mean, and the museum is no longer a problem. So far as the community of artists goes, it seems to me the question would involve the question of difference between us and other artists, in the way that we may have a feeling of community.
To continue with the suggestion I made before, I would like to suggest that the question of method might be broken down into this. First, it is possible to say why we begin to create a work. Second, how do we begin the work? From an idea, an emotional point of view based on experience, or form? Where does the suggestion come from? Third, when is the work finished? How do we know that? I can't see that my relationship to a museum or to the public is concerned with what I am making. I'm interested in how other people work. A very great Chinese painter once said, the most difficult thing in your work of art is to know the moment when to stop.
The question then is, how do you know when a work is finished?
I don't know if I can consider that question without thinking about the first two questions. I would say the work seems finished to me when it concludes successfully the prophecy of its beginning and the problems involved in its working out. It may be that in my work, by nature, almost determines its own conclusion. It is not possible to make any changes once the thing is quite far along. The early suggestion from form take place for many of us at this stage of sketching or small models, model making. If you have to make a model, and when that phase comes to an end, I then begin to work on the piece itself or the larger piece, so far as it seems to be more or less a technical process. I would like to say a little about the beginning of my method. I have never begun a piece from the point of view of a pure form. I have never made two pieces without springing from the memory of some experience, an emotional experience, generally. I almost always from the beginning have a title which labels the experience, because I want to act as a discipline in eliminating any exurious ideas which might come into the sculpture. As we all know, the first line or brush stroke can lead to millions of possibilities, and for me to keep clear is to keep a title in mind. It is a value to me at the beginning. When an experience has made itself so present in my unconscious or conscious mind or both, that I feel that I want to make something which reflects that experience. I find my eyes constantly observing all things. While that experience is a memory, suitable forms can be suggested in a number of objects in life. A line of someone's face or a crack in the floor or an experience at the newsreel theater. When the problem of how to work out that experience which presents itself, I may begin with that idea, and I have apt it into my medium. I have to make it clear enough for others to see the relationships. All of this takes place in the sketch phase, in the models I make that I make from drawings. The drawings become more conclusive as I work. Generally, I work on a piece that I make very few changes. I can't talk about conscious without talking about intent. On the rare occasion I have seen a form which suggests some kind of relationship which called back a memory or experience, it is always an interplay between the two, I find. It is never one thing or the other.
I think quite often I don't know when a work of art is finished, because I often carry it a little too far. There is some peculiar balance which is necessary to preserve all through a painting, which keeps it fluid and moving. It can't be brought to a stop. I think you have to abandon it while it's still alive and moving, and so I can't consider a painting finished. I can't think of working with a clear intent on a painting, because it often develops as I go. It quite often changes in the middle of a painting, but the end is a very difficult thing, something that is determined not by the form that is finished, but by the fact that I've worked on it. It satisfies a need of some kind.
It's usually finished when it defies me to do anything more with it. I start with drawings, and then when I find that the drawings are incapable of being turned into a painting, then I start to paint.
I consider my painting finished when my eye goes to a particular spot on the canvas. But if I put the picture away about 20 feet on the wall, and the movements keep returning to me, and my eye seems to be responding to something living, then it is finished.
I usually ask my wife. I think a more interesting question would be, why does anyone start a painting instead of finishing it?
I would say that I don't think any piece of sculpture I make is really finished, nor do I think it's possible to call a piece a realization of any particular idea evolving from a specific emotion or event. There's a stream of consciousness out of which these things pop like waves and fall back. therefore works aren't really complete in themselves. I think the day of the masterpiece is over. When we look at our own work, in 10 or 15 examples, we really understand what we're doing. The sense of finishing a particular work is meaningless.
I would like to ask you if what you describe applies to an individual piece. It is a thing which exists within its own particular shape. How can that come about?
For a sculptor to insist that a piece of sculpture rises out of his stream of consciousness is perhaps ridiculous, because sculpture is so three-dimensional and hard. But I don't believe there's any great difference between one piece and another in the development and the fulfillment of a particular aesthetic idea, which may permeate several works.
Well, I would consider a work finished when I sense a togetherness, a participation of all parts as in an organism. This doesn't mean that I entirely understand what I have created, but to me, a work is at first quite unknown. In time, more and more enters into consciousness. It would be better to consider a work of art as a process that is started by the artist. In that way of thinking, a sculpture or a painting is never finished, but only begun. If successful, the work starts to live a life of its own. A work of art begins to work.
My work consists of two separate stages of development. I consider a painting almost finished when I'm half finished with it, or when I have reached what seems to be the greatest measure of surprise. The rest of the action is disciplinary on my part. When I see that I'm beginning to destroy the surprise, the basic element of that surprise, then it's time for me to stop.
For me, it's finished when it's inevitable within itself. But I don't think I can explain anything about my painting, just as I can't explain anything about a flower or a child. When is anything beautiful or finished? I can't discuss things about my paintings. The true thing I'm after goes on and on and on, and I can never completely grasp it.
I think that we require time and intimacy and aloneness.
I never know when it's finished. I only know there comes a time when I have to stop.
I think the idea of a finished picture is a fiction. I think a man spends his whole lifetime painting one picture or working on one piece of sculpture. The question of stopping is really a decision of moral considerations, pretty much. To what extent are you intoxicated by the actual act, so that you're beguiled by it? To what extent are you charmed by its inner life? And to what extent do you then really approach the intention or desire that's really outside of it? The decision is always made when the piece has something in it that you wanted.
A work is never finished. The energies involved in a particular work are really transferred at a certain moment to the next work.
When it stops, why does it stop? While the hands do, the picture moves, having a life, objective, emotional, and intellectual, of its own. When I can do no more on it, it is done.
Painting is for me a problem of simultaneous understanding and explaining. I try to approach my subject uncluttered by aesthetic prejudices. I put it on canvas in order to explain it to myself, yet the result should reveal something plus. As I work, the thing takes a life and fights back. There comes a moment when I can't continue. Then I stop until next time.
I refrain from finishing it. I paint myself out of the picture, and when I've done that, I either throw it away or keep it. I am always in the picture somewhere. The amount of space I use, I am always in. I seem to move around it. And there seems to be a time when I lose sight of what I wanted to do, and then I am out of it. If the picture has a contenance, I keep it. If it hasn't, I throw it away. I am not really very much interested in the question.
I think a work is finished when I have nothing to eliminate. I make constructions that are usually vertical. When I start them, they are full of colors and are complicated in form. Every one of the complications goes and the color becomes uniform, and finally they become completely white and simple. When there is nothing else to take away, it's finished. Yet I am disgusted by simplicity, so I look for a larger form and for another work, which goes through the same process of elimination.
A work of art is never really finished. There is a feeling of trying to express the labyrinth of one's mind, its feelings, its emotions, and to fulfill one's personality. Each work is trying to complete the expression of that personality. Whether it becomes profound, I don't know. But I think an artist is very aware of himself in relation to the rest of the world.
It has always been a problem for me about finishing paintings. I am very conscious of ways of finishing paintings. Among modern artists, there is a value placed on unfinished work. Disturbances arise when you have to treat the work as a finished and complete object. So that the only time that I think finish a painting is when I have a deadline. If you're going to present it as an unfinished object, how do you finish it?
I have stopped, I think, when I have arrived at a quality of mystery. I know this doesn't describe it, but it is the best word I can use.
To me, a work is finished when all parts involved communicate themselves so that they don't need me.
I dislike a picture that is too suave or too skillfully done. But contrariwise, I also dislike a picture that looks too inept or blundering. I noticed in looking at the Carré exhibition of young French painters, who are supposed to be close to this group, that in finishing a painting, they assume traditional criteria to a much greater degree than we do. They have a real finish in that the picture is a real object, a beautifully made object. We are involved in process, and what is a finished object is not so certain.
Yes, it seems to me that all that there is a question of heritage. It would seem that the difference between the young French painters and the young American painters is this. French painters have a cultural heritage. American painters of today approaches this without a bias. The French approach things on the basis of cultural heritages that one feels in all of their work. It is a working towards a refinement and quality rather than working towards new experiences and painting out these experiences that may become tradition. The French have it easier. They have it in the beginning.
I'm glad you brought up that point. It seems to me that in Europe, every time something new is needed to be done, it was done because of traditional culture. Ours has been a striving to come to the same point that we had, not to be iconoclasts.
There are those who feel that the things which we make are simply moments in a continuum, and therefore in themselves are not objects for their own sakes, but just moments in the continuum. Is there an irreconceivable in making an object in itself, which at the same time reflects community? This, so far, has been spoken of incompletely.
But that means that you have decided already exactly what is beautiful. Beauty can't be pursued directly.
There's a general assumption that Europeans, specifically French painters, have a heritage which enables them to have the benefits of tradition, and therefore they can produce a certain type of painting. It seems to me that in the last 50 years, the whole meaning of painting has been made international. I think Americans share that heritage just as much, and that if they deviate from tradition, it is just as difficult for an American as for a Frenchman. It is a mistaken assumption in some quarters that any departure from tradition stems from ignorance. I think that what Motherwell describes is the problem of knowing what tradition is and being willing to reject it in part. This requires familiarity with his past. I think we have this familiarity, and if we depart from tradition, it is out of knowledge, not innocence.
I agree that tradition is part of the whole world now. The point that was brought up was that French artists have some touch in making an object. They have a particular something that makes them look like a finished painting. They have a touch which I am glad not to have. We're getting mixed up with the French tradition in talking about the necessity to finish a thing, then we then said American painters finish a thing that looks unfinished, and the French, they finish it. I've seen Matisse's that were more unfinished yet finished than any American painter. Matisse was obviously in a terrific emotion at the time, and it was more unfinished than finished.
The second day, April 22nd, 1950.
I think that the titling of paintings is a problem. The titles a painter gives his paintings help to classify him, and this is wrong. A long poetic title or number, whatever you do seems a statement of attitude. The same thing if you give a descriptive title. Even refraining from giving any at all creates a misunderstanding.
If a title does not mean anything and creates a misunderstanding, why put a title on a painting?
To me, a title is nothing but identification. I always have a very hard time finding a title, and it's always inadequate. I think that when titles are very suggestive, they are kind of a fraud, because they throw the spectator away from the picture rather than into it. But numbers are inadequate.
I think the point Miss Stern raised is inevitable. That is, whenever an artist puts a title on a painting, some interpretation about his attitude will be made. It seems obvious that titles are necessary when everybody uses them, whether verbal or numbers. For purposes of exhibition, identification and the benefit of the critics, there must be some way of referring to a picture. It seems to me that the artist, in making up titles for his pictures, must decide what his attitude is.
And most people seem to think that titles are a kind of necessity. Does anyone think that titles have any real usefulness in supplementing the object?
The title is always arbitrary, because we deal with unseen audiences. The reason for a title is that every Tom, Dick, and Harry has to have some link. Once I had a show where I had numbers from 1 to 20, and it came to a question of reviewing, the critics found that number 6 was better than 4, etc. I hope that the onlooker will make up his own title.
I think if we could agree on numbers, it would be a tremendous thing. In music, they don't have this dilemma. It would force people just to look at the object and to try to find their own experience.
I would object to doing any such thing as that, such as numbering a picture. I don't particularly care what people classify me as, or whether people understand the title or not. It suggests something to me, or something may pop into my head, so I give it that title.
I think titles are a positive means of identification. I've never objected to any work of art because of its title. The only people who have objected were critics because they didn't like the work.
The question of abandoning titles arose, I am sure, because of aesthetic reasons. Even titles like Still Life and Landscape do not say anything about the painting. If a painting does have a reference or association of some kind, I think the artist is apt to add a title. I think this is why titles are not used by many great modern painters, because they don't have anything to do with the painting itself.
Well, there's some painters who attach a great deal of importance to titles.
I think Stern is dealing with a real problem. What is the content of our work? What are we really doing? The question is how to name what has, as of yet, been unnamed.
I'd like to get some information on this. Would you raise your hands if you name your pictures and sculptures? Okay. How many people merely number their pictures, say? All right. How many don't title their pictures at all?
It seems to me a minor problem. There are, in general, two kinds of titles, the poetic and those that note content. A number seems to me only to be a refusal to accept responsibility. Whereas certain people start with a recollection or an experience and paint that experience. To some of us, the act of doing it becomes the experience, so we are not quite clear why we are engaged on a particular work. And because we are more interested in plastic matters than we are in a manner of words, one can begin a picture and carry it through and stop it and do nothing about the title at all. All pictures are full of association.
Titles are very important in surrealist work. But the emphasis with us is on a painting experience and not on any other experience. The only objection I have to a title is when it is a false or tricky, or is something added that the painting itself does not have.
I don't think anybody really has a right to know exactly how I feel about my paintings. It seems too intimate to give them a subjective title.
You think it's possible to enrich the painting by words?
I think that if an artist can always title his pictures, that means he's not always very clear.
In titling a construction, I've used combinations of words or syllables without any meaning. But lately I've adopted the use of the names of stars or other celestial objects, similar to the way ships are named. Such titles are just names, and they aren't to imply the construction. They imply that the construction expresses or symbolizes or represents anything. A work of art is like a work of nature.
What we all have been saying is that the designation of a painting or a piece of sculpture has become more important as a problem than it has been before. An assumption or a crucifixion needed no title. I think that numbering pieces is really begging the question, because numbering the piece is an admission or a statement or a manifesto that this is pure painting or sculpture, that it stands by itself without relation to any other discipline. We should not cut ourselves off from this great, rich world.
I don't know how much longer this discussion of titling works will go on. There are a good many interesting implications. It seems to me there are three levels of titles. First, simply as a matter of convenience, or second, questions of titles as explanations or a kind of finger point, and which do not work particularly well. And third, the surrealist title, in which the words are a positive part of the work of art, and there is an attraction or a conflict set up between the words and the picture. It's the second of those that I would like to hear some conversation about, the question of specific emotion in the work of art. The general public is very much interested in that factor of the work. How did the artist feel when he did the thing?
There was that cave of paintings which were found in France just lately. Were those works of art before they were discovered? This is the question.
Well, I'd like to go back to Mr. Leopold's question. Are we involved in self-expression or in the world? It seems to Leopold that you cannot be involved in the world if you are a craftsman, but if you're involved in the world, you cannot be an artist. We're in the process of making the world, to a certain extent, in our own image. This removes us from the craft level.
This difficulty of titling or not titling a picture, we ought to have more faith in the world. If you really express the world, those things eventually will turn out more or less good. I know what Newman means. It is some kind of feeling that you want to give yourself a place in the world.
Well, about specifying, if you specify your emotions, whether they are agony or fear, etc., I believe it's bad manners to actually say one is feeling bad.
I think there are different experiences or emotions. I feel certain parts of you ought to be left off, ought to leave up to the world.
I think we start from a subjective attitude, which in the process of our endeavor becomes related to the world.
I want to add to what Newman has said, which is that it is impossible to escape an attitude towards the world. I would like to bring into this discussion, if possible, the artist, not as being, but as man, and not as a mere practitioner and craftsman, because if we have any integrity at all, it is as men and women.
Why does the modern artist feel the need to sign his work?
When we make a work of art, we must get our praise after it's finished.
In certain cultures, none of the works were ever signed.
If you were commissioned to do a picture of the Madonna in the Middle Ages, that was praise to begin with.
I think the answer is that the work that really has something to say constitutes its own signature.
There's no such thing as being anonymous. A man's work is his signature. in this sense, art has never been anonymous.
It is a beautiful question. In our society, with manufacturers, businessmen, etc., it is necessary to sign something for the purposes of identity. But still, the thing is, how could one maintain an identity without signing? Who wants to title a work, to sign a work?
But how are you going to get that to the public?
You're interested in the problem of how to get your painting to the public?
During the period of Impressionism, you had the artists showing their work in cafes and other places where they ate. At one time, they were exhibiting in the open-air shows in the village. Then there was the Federal Art Project. People no longer have this intimacy with artists, but the public does not know actually what is going on, what is being done by the painter. I remember organizing for a union on the waterfront. People then didn't know the function of a union or what was good about it, but gradually they were made aware of it. They saw a need for it. The same is true of our relationship with the people. In making them aware of what we are doing, certainly you're going to run into ignorance.
Sometimes a young artist becomes too quickly known. He already is a member of the reaction, and he can't help it. It is not always such a good thing to find yourself an accepted part of the culture.
Exactly what is our involvement, our relation to the outside world? I think everyone should be asked to say something about this.
Well, apparently many people don't want to answer the question.
I think somebody who professes something is never a professor. I think we are craftsmen, but we really don't know exactly what we are ourselves, but we have no position in the world, absolutely no position, except that we just insist upon being around.
I'm rather happy with my position in society. In other words, I would much rather be unattached to any part of society than to be commissioned to carve a picture of Mr. Truman because I'm not interested in that. I think what we are overlooking here, and I've believed this for a long time, is the fact that we cannot draw our reaction altogether from the present, nor can we create out of past experience alone.
It seems to me before we examine our position in relation to the world, we should examine our position in relation to each other. I understand that to be the point of this discussion, and that's why we came together. I'm sure there are a number of people who are interested in the matter of self-expression alone, and there are others who aren't really. I would like to emphasize Mr. Motherwell's remarks, though. We have two problems. First, the problem of existing as men, and second, the problem of growth in our work. There seems to be some feeling that this is a practical body rather than a deliberative. Do you want to discuss whether you want to do something practical or go ahead in the search of what we call truth?
The third day. The questions we all have written down fall into three categories, though they overlap. And one is a series of questions that are historical, which Grippe, Ernst, Herr, Reinhardt, Barr, and Gottlieb ask. The largest number of questions are strictly aesthetic questions about the process of creation and about the quality of creative works. The questions of Ferber, Herr, Baziotis, Lippold, Smith, Stern, Hoffman, Biala, Lasso, and Bourgeois. Five people, Poussette, Dart, Lipton, Tomlin, Newman, and Brooks, have asked an identical question, a question of community. What is it that binds us together, if there is something that binds us together? Would you like me to read all the questions, either anonymously or signed?
Read them signed. To what extent are the artists in this group making use of some of the methods and theories that were developed by the various earlier movements and groups of modern art? Are the artists in this group searching for a personal vocabulary? And if so, what is their method of familiarizing their public with this language? Is not a pure painting a self-portrait?
What is your work of art? Do you consider the production of it a professional activity? Do you belong to artist equality? Why or why not?
Is there any difference in direction between advanced American and French painting or sculpture? If there is a difference, what is its nature and what does it mean?
Do you work from a previously formed concept, or does your work become its own inspiration as it progresses? What do you feel about the unavoidable changes which are forced upon a work during its birth, which do you feel is of fundamental value to you? The success which you are able to say it, or the importance to which you have to say? Do you paint your subject, or is painting your subject? Subject in the sense of content, not in the sense of realism versus abstraction. Of what value do you feel your work is of to society, if any? What changes would you wish to effect, and why?
What's the most acceptable name for your direction or movement? It's been called abstract expressionist, abstract symbolist, intra-subjectivist, etc. I now jump to the third category and ask if there is any unity here at all.
Is there anything that binds this group together historically?
Can we find some binding factor or practical common denominator between us? A common purpose upon which we can all work as well as talk? Perhaps each to paint or sculpt upon an agreed subject, theme, or idea, or problem, and exhibit these works together, myself preferring neither signature nor titles. Assuming that painters in this group hold similar views in relation to the picture plane, are there other plastic convictions held in common sufficient to establish a body of objective criteria? Does painting, which excludes automatic technical processes, but which involves a concern with the subconscious, necessarily fall in the classification of subjective? What ties us together as a community of artists?
What are the qualities, or is the quality, in their work that establishes a community of artists of which this roundtable is a section?
What can we do about making a group such as this more permanent in coming together or on an artistic and social basis? Now we come to the group of questions that seem to me to tend to be strictly aesthetic.
Is painting leading sculpture, or have they separated?
Conceding that an all-embracing definition or explanation of art has not yet been generally accepted by artists, it would be of great interest and enlightening both to the public and fellow artists alike if each member of this roundtable answers in his own way the question, what is art?
Like many of us, I was raised on the notion of painterliness. That is what is most moving in painting is just its painterly quality. But what I think of the art that I love, for example, the art of Spain, with its passion and noblesse, I wonder if painterliness is not meant to serve something beyond itself. And it is then that I question a great deal in modern art. Consequently, is modern painting impoverishing itself, and is this inevitable?
What do you think quality is?
Is art a problem of how or what?
Is it possible to make a work while under the influence of immediate experience, i.e. fear, disgust, love, etc.?
What do you feel is more important in the art movement today, intuition or reason?
Can purity in the arts be compared to the medieval notion of discussing how many angels can stand on the head of a pin? A notion of refined, disembodied essence, which is no longer consonant with modern ideas, which embrace the whole man and his human engagements. The genesis of a work of art, or in what circumstance is a work of art born? Definition of the term genesis, process of creation. Is it the process of being born or the process of giving birth? 2. What causes the work of art to be born? What is the primary impulse? What makes the artist work? Is it to escape from depression, filling a void? Is it to record confidence or pleasure? Is it to understand and solve a formal problem and reorder the world? 3. What conditions the birth and growth of the work of art? A. Before the act of creation, sociological aspect, surroundings and milieu. Taine Otto theory of the milieu. Personal aspect. B. During the process of creation, experience undergone while the work is being done. resistance of the medium, properties of the medium.
I would suggest, to expedite matters, that we vote on which category of these three groups we wish to begin with. Most people here are involved in the aesthetic question and would prefer to give it preference, no doubt. Would it seem agreeable to vote?
There are really only two categories. Historical and community are really the same thing. The question of community is, in practice, the historical problem and would take less time than the aesthetic question.
The questions that are dealing with the creative process tend to revolve around the question of how a work originates, what is really referring to, and in that sense, what its actual content is and how clearly it is known at the inception. And the other series dealing with the creative process tend to revolve around the question of quality, what quality is. However, it also involves some social problems. Why are we together? Shall we begin with the questions that have to do with origin? It seemed to me quite clear the first day that there are two differences mentioned which overlap. One is a notion that a work in its beginning has its conclusion implied. The conclusion follows the original line of thought, and the process is to cut out anything that is irrelevant to that line of thought. The other notion is a notion of improvising, that one begins like a blind swimmer, and that what one finds en route often alters the original intent. The people who work like that are involved in the problem of inspiration. That's enough to annoy somebody, perhaps.
I wasn't making any point about inspiration.
Would you say a work was an experience of discovery, that you're turning up new stones?
Stern said that any other position involves an a priori notion of what beauty is.
You have to know if you're...
We have moved forward only when a specific problem presents itself and we have grouped around for a conclusion. I attempted to explain that my method seems to be to have a problem which to begin and then proceed with it. I would like to intake some questions which have been suggested which have to do with the genesis of the work.
What about this problem of how a piece is begun?
I think Ms. Stern's question has to do with origin. I would ask regarding origin, is it a question of wanting to say a specific thing or of how one says it? And where do the two meet? Do we begin with the necessity of to convey a message, or do we become intrigued with the way it is to be said?
Could the process which I suggested as one process be compared to the way in which one handles a kaleidoscope? One's relationship to the world in which we live might be a kind of base from which one starts. If you turn the kaleidoscope, you stop an image, which takes form in a satisfactory way, and the painting becomes the realization of that image, which is only a moment in the whole process. Then you turn the kaleidoscope and make another image.
Are the elements in the kaleidoscope essentially how-nesses or what-nesses?
I think that for the artist himself, the problem is not beauty ever. It's one of accuracy, validity, and life.
Would you say preoccupation with the idea of beauty is a bad thing?
No, but it doesn't lead anywhere, because beauty is a matter of conception.
A concern with beauty is a concern with what is known. Beauty is unattainable, yet it is what gives art its significance. It is the unknown. The artist's intention is what gives a specific thing form. I have the feeling that in the art world, beauty has become a discredited word. I've heard people say that you can't use the word God, but when a word becomes trite, it's not the word that's become trite, but the people who use it.
I'm not here to define anything, but to give life to what I have the urge to give life to. We live by the particular, not by the general.
It is not necessary for Stern to define beauty for what she is saying. Beauty is not for her the primary source of inspiration. She thinks that beauty is discovered en route.
Is there anyone here who considers himself a producer of beautiful objects?
I agree with Stern that we are always concerned with the particular, not the general. Any general discussion of aesthetics is a discussion of philosophy. Any conclusion can apply to any work of art. Why not have people tell us why they do what they do? Why does Brooks use swirling shapes? Why Newman a straight line? What is it that makes each person use those particular forms that they use?
I agree with Miss Stern. The question of beauty does not inspire the creator, but is a result of recognition. I feel Stern's view is valid. The work of art is an end result. The other concern formulated by Libel of an eye of an, a priori kind of view, I see Stern's concept of art in its relation to beauty, why she is concerned with beauty, yet leaves it out of the discussion.
You have been listening to Blindspot, Studio 35, a retelling of a series of discussions that occurred in New York 56 years ago. Featuring the voice talents of Anna Clark, Julia Klein, Brian Taylor, Eric S. Humphrey, and John Wanzel. The program was engineered by Philip Unzweck and produced by Julia Klein and John Wanzel. Each week, Blindspot presents a unique live radio experience that explores the possibilities of the medium. For more information about the program, please visit our website at stopgostop.com/blindspot. Join us next week for The Cats Away, produced by Eric S. Humphrey. Thank you for listening. This has been Blindspot.